or call 917-781-0366. The opinions expressed are those of the WBAI local station board and do not necessarily represent those of WBAI or the Pacifica Foundation.
Well, it is 10 p.m., WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. It's time now for Night Shift. However, Night Shift is not yet available for broadcast at this time. So, how about a little music?
Yeah. next day was much as the previous. You know how they talk of the walls closing in? Well, I was looking for a door. An exit. Checking at a hotel. That's what you do. No phone. No view. No you.
How does it feel?
It feels like times have changed.
To be here, it is always appropriate to be here, contemplate. If you ever happen to be someplace and you contemplate, I'm not here, where are you? So in this moment, be here, wherever here happens to be. In this day and time, we have gathered together to contemplate, to dialogue this that is called...
I'll be damn late.
Now, where are my people? 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 Where are my people?
I'm talking about it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I remember.
Suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
Executive Order AUC-3423.
Listen to this, boys.
Night shift again. 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 Night shift again.
I'll be damn late.
You're tuned to listener-sponsored radio. The name of the show. I'm Mike Sargent. The name of the show is Night Shift. And here on Night Shift, we always say that life is like science fiction. And the perspective is that human beings and the way they act is literally a science fiction movie, or at least it is to me. Back in March, we did a show called The Power of Words. And we had a special guest on, Ben Zimmer. We talked about words. And we had two co-hosts on. We had Sean Richards, who is an actor, activist, and someone who uses words in their daily work, their daily, what they do, what, and I'm calling you they, Sean, what you do.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Okay. What they do that. In their livelihood. And then we had, of course, the incomparable Leanne Lord. Leanne Lord, who is a humorist, a motivational speaker, a wordsmith, an author, someone who uses words to both hilarious and insightful effect. So we talked about the power of words. Words. I do radio. I produce podcasts, so I'm always using words. But here's the question about words. There is more to just words. There is something called linguistics. There's something called sociophonetics. There's something called neurolinguistics. There are all these aspects of language that once you start to explore them and you look at how human beings communicate, it makes you wonder, makes you realize, or maybe perhaps take in even further, just how much power words have. when we had Ben Zimmer on, one of the people who was following Ben Zimmer was a woman named Kelly E. Wright, and she listed herself as a raciolinguist. I'm like, what the hell is a raciolinguist? Yeah. To me, that is total science fiction. That's like Uhura. She can speak 1,000 languages, you know? So I'm like, all right. And so I totally started following her, and I think I even reached out to her. And then Ben, after the show, said, hey, you know, you should talk to Kelly E. Wright. And I'm thinking, all right, Kelly E. Wright. So finally, we connected. And all I have to say is, ladies and gentlemen, you are in for an interesting, mind-bending, mind-expanding episode of Night Shift.
Are they? What is their?
Sean
what
Richards,
am I perceiving as their gender?
Sean Richards, how are you?
I am in such deep awe of Kelly Wright. Kelly E. Wright.
Kelly okay. E.
Know, right?
Wright.
Is it the?
Right.
Is it the? Not only the language, but is it the letters? We have to really.
That's listen.
We have to coddle them and hug them.
It stands for Excelsior. No, all right. Ooh. So, Kelly Wright, welcome to Night Shift.
Thank you all so much. I'm really happy to be here.
All right. So just to set our audience up with you a little bit, the theme of the show is that racial linguistics and how language shapes our conceptions about race. Reading your bio, I'm going to read it here on the air because it's like to the average person, it's like, okay. And then I want you to tell it to us, you know, in the cheap seats, exactly what it is that you do. So it says, Kelly writes research in sociophonetics, neurolinguistics, and historical sociolinguistics focuses on the link between linguistic production and perception. Now, linguistic production perception alone, I just want to pause and think about that. Okay. She applies mixed methodologies, including machine learning, massive corpora studies, perceptual and cognitive experimentation, and quantitative, phonetic, and qualitative sociolinguistic analysis. Now, she's not from Vulcan, okay, but... First of all, let me ask you, Kelly, how did you get so interested in language? And please lead us into your thesis in college.
Okay. Thank you for reading my very academic introduction. So thinking about just those first few things, neurolinguistics, sociophonetics, and historical sociolinguistics. Neurolinguistics is studying how language works in the brain. So the electrochemical ends of production and perception, right? How we move our articulators, which could be the organs in your mouth or your hands, right? To communicate, and, you know, the muscles and neurons and everything that have to do with that. And then also the perceiving end, how we hear and, you know, visually how we interact with language. How we produce language and how it structures our thoughts. The sociophonetics aspect focuses specifically on the production and perception loop. So the idea is I produce a sound. That sound has a history. There's a reason why it belongs to the varieties that I know, the languages that I know. And when I'm listening to someone else make a sound or read a sentence, my brain is doing multiple things at once. It's parsing the sound. It's saying, you said truck, right? I heard truck, right? You said truck. But it's also telling me who was speaking. How old are they? What am I perceiving as their gender, their race? How far away from me are they if we're in the room, right? So we get lots of physical information through sound as well. And as we know, our physical traits are tied to social history. So historical sociolinguistics comes in for me in studying language ideology, how our ideas about language have been shaped over time in relation to social history, but also like the material history of the world. So like the built environment has a lot of language in it. So we think about how we interact with the world in historical periods of time, like brains don't fossilize. So I can't, you know, go back and look at a mummy and know what language was doing in their heads. The only thing I have to make sense of that is social history. So those are the big branches that I participate in. And yeah, I got interested in language. I guess I've always been interested in language. I grew up in the church. I did a lot of singing. I was really into show tunes. My grandmother had nerve deafness, so she went completely deaf by the time she was 16. And she still was the person who taught me everything about music because she could remember symphonies and Broadway shows and things like this that she saw when she was younger. So just making meaning with language, connecting our self-expression to our emotions and identity, all that's been part of my life. And then I was in college and I found out that linguistics was a thing, and I basically haven't stopped since.
First of all, I love the idea of calling your hands, your mouth, your tongue articulators, because I definitely want to tell some people to just mind your articulators, all right? But the other thing I have to question is, I might argue that brains do not fossilize, because I've seen living people who are in government now where it seems that their brains have fossilized to me. Tell me about your thesis paper in college.
Are you wanting to know about what I'm doing now or what I've done previously?
I want to hear about Serena.
You want to hear about Serena? Okay.
Yes, and then we'll get to now. We'll get to
okay. Okay. So yes, my master's thesis is about Serena Williams. So she's been a constant figure in my life as a pop cultural icon. Given a few analytical tools as a sociolinguist, noticed that the way she's been described in the media is different than her white counterparts. So I studied that phenomenon by building a corpus of sports journalism. At this point, the corpus has 8.5 million words and covers 120 athletes.
All right, for those in the cheap seats, explain what a corpus is.
A corpus is just a group of texts. So these are all articles from, you know, places like Time or, tennis magazine, things like that, about individual athletes. So it's just pieces of journalism put together. The patterns in this text tell us that the language used to describe athletes of color is measurably different, demonstrably different than the language used to describe white athletes. And so that's where the machine learning comes in, is I have a large body of text. I asked an algorithm to look at the observed pattern in the text. And so they run the analysis. The algorithm runs the analysis many, 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 many times. And we get a very convincing and stable result. So it's able to predict the race of an athlete from just a piece of text, but with like a 96% accuracy.
Wow. Wow. All right. Wow. All right. So before I even have you define raciolinguistics in your own terms and what you do now, I want to know if Sean and Leanne had any questions for you.
I do have a quick question. In terms of defining the athlete, is it the words that the athlete is using or words that other people are using about the athlete?
Great question. Technically both, but really what most of these articles were describing an athlete. Some of them included quotes, like interview quotes, but most of them were just someone being talked about instead of them describing themselves. Although these athletes absolutely do use some of these racialized words in their own conversations.
Okay, and Sean, you had a question.
Well, considering that Venus and Serena are, I find them to be very soft-spoken, I really want to understand how they are described. And the words, is it a tone? Like, is it a light tone in speaking about them? Or is it a heavy tone? Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're listening, if you're getting words pulled, are you listening to the audio of these words being pulled? Or are you just getting the actual word?
Well, what I'm looking at is just text. So just an article that is out. If I didn't look at any video data, although I'd be anxious to do so at some point. But the words are actually very interesting. So when people think about racialization, which is similar to gendering, we say that language has been like gendered. Mm-hmm. That racialization is similar, right? It's not really an active process. It's a consequence of race being a thing and people like using language to describe and outline it. And so there are words that you wouldn't expect to be racialized. So for example, a word like athletic, right? Mm-hmm. Which we would expect athletic to be, show no imbalance, to be balanced across the actors in these corpus, right? Because they're all world-class athletes. But we see that descriptions of Black people tend towards being more physically based than skill-based. And so we're talking more about their athleticism directly. And so that word becomes imbalanced. Whereas you have another word, like something like Rolex, where Rolex is entirely imbalanced towards the white half of the subcorpus. There were black athletes that had deals with Rolex, but those endorsements were not mentioned or were not present in these like articles that are talking about an individual. Whereas like with the white athletes, it's something that's like front and center. And so nobody would walk out and say the word Rolex is racist. That isn't the argument here. The argument is that it is used more often in descriptions of one population than another.
Context. Interesting. I wanted to ask you about this because I feel it leads into the work you're doing now and leads into, hopefully for the listener, the idea of how words not only can be racialized, but perpetuate certain things, certain existing belief systems within the culture. So there's another term. I want to get your definition of what raciolinguistics is, but there's a term that in researching, because there's all these, it's almost impossible to not sound academic when you talk about raciolinguistics. One phrase that's used, and I want to understand it. I think I have an understanding, but I want my audience and co-host to understand it. The co-naturalization of language and race. Now, when they say something like the historical and contemporary co-naturalization of language and race, what does that mean?
Yeah. So, okay. Basically, in my opinion, you don't really get the modern conception of language without the construction of race, the modern construction of race. And so the idea that you speak like a German language or an English, like the English language being something that is only accessible to people in North America or the UK or Australia, right? And not, there's already a racial distinction in saying I speak English because English is a global language and it's spoken by many non-white people, but people don't assume that like when you say I'm an English speaker. You can't really claim ownership of a language without also sort of claiming other identity aspects, and race is one of them. So when we're looking at raciolinguistics as a field, this co-naturalization really has to do with the modern development of race as a concept and how language itself is part of that creation. So for example, in the United States, it was illegal to teach Black people to read. People could be killed or flogged for doing that or imprisoned. And so Black people did not have access to self-expression or the material creation of knowledge for well over a century. Their race kept them from participating in, you know, the fullness of their language system as a neural system, right? Because the creation of knowledge is something that happens individually in our own like minds. And so there's no way that race and language, the practice of like a linguistic identity today, is not, you know, part and parcel to the practice of race as well.
So now, in your own words, what is raciolinguistics? Because you mentioned how in college you discovered that linguistics was a thing, but you've gone way, way, way beyond that. So what is, for those who don't, at this point, I think people listening should have some sense of what raciolinguistics is, but what's your definition of it and why does it excite you?
Great question. So linguistics in general is the scientific study of language. Language intersects, you know, language manifests in lots of different ways, right? And so raciolinguistics, to me, is the study of race as this like category, as a superordinate, you know, grouping. So I study the historical construction of race. And then I study how it sort of manifests and is maintained. So in the ways we talk about different racial groups, in our laws, in institutional policy, all of these things are written, so have a linguistic component. I specifically look at how language ideologies play out for negative outcomes for the historically excluded groups of people. So I don't look at language structure in the ways that some other linguists might, like morphologists look at parts of words, how they come together to form them. And historical linguists look at, you know, ancient states of language. But I look at how language functions in the world.
And you are still tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and we are speaking with Kelly E. Wright, who is a raciolinguist, and we've been talking about the power and study of language from all these different perspectives that perhaps maybe you never really considered that people were studying it that intensely. So I want to give a chance for Sean and Leanne to ask any questions they had so far, because I have a lot of questions that I want to ask our guest. Leanne, did you have any questions you wanted to ask at this point?
I do, but Sean had a question first.
All right, Sean.
Question actually was regarding, I don't know if I would say tone, but sometimes enunciation. Does that play a part? Does that ever play a part when you are, I guess, I don't know, reading text? Do you think that sometimes the enunciation, you, when you're reading it, is different from the way it's written? And sometimes that is where you come up with your conclusions or your idea or proven fact?
When you're asking, when I'm reading it, are you talking about for like the corpus work?
Yes, for the corpus, yes.
Yeah. So I actually am not reading it. The algorithm is the one who's reading it. And really, Yeah, and really, those assessments come from just raw word counts. So I'm just counting the words that appear. There is actually no analysis deeper than just counting them and seeing the frequencies in which they appear. So the patterns are, it actually goes to show you how, like pronounced these patterns are, because we can just see them by just really stacking up all of the words and looking at which ones are used for whom.
That's so, oh my God. I think I am just going to like sit in a room, like literally sit in a room and just look at a book and not read it and just try to psychically communicate with an inanimate object. I'm not even kidding you.
Wow. Well, that's a Sunday.
All right. So Leanne, I know you had a question too.
Actually, I'm enjoying taking this all in because this is not my area of expertise. It's clearly my area of interest. You know, I was an English major. I was brought up in the respectability politics generation where there was a clear distinction made between the language spoken with your little friends and the language you spoke to adults, to teachers, to parents, to power. And it was really sort of drummed into you early that if you wanted any level of credibility, if you wanted to be seen as right and correct and professional, you had to speak and write and communicate in a certain way, you know. And I will say it is very difficult to step away from that, but it's at minimum two different ways of speaking and walking and writing and conducting yourself in the world. So I find this absolutely fascinating.
This is so much going on. This is like, this is like mental orgasms. Okay. My mind is absolutely blown. I do voiceover and this is even like hitting that part about that and just all of the things that I discuss with an agent. And this is just, I don't even know what to say.
I remember back in the day going in for auditions and, you know, they had to word it very carefully when they wanted you to sound more urban. Like they had to be very careful with their language. But I just remember I would be sitting in the waiting room with classically trained actors. You know,
Juilliard.
Folks who I had seen, you know, on HBO and movies.
Law and Order.
Right.
8-week episode, you know what I mean?
And in there speaking the king's and queen's English. And then you get behind the mic for a McDonald's commercial.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the quote unquote hood comes out. Oh, I never booked it either, but I was just happy to be in the waiting room with these people because that in and of itself was an education. And it's like, so you're taking these people who have spent time and money to emulate what mainstream culture is. And now you're asking them to, yeah, can you do some hood stuff? Can you be urban? Mm-hmm. You know, and if I had a dollar for every time someone said, oh yeah, yeah, Leanne, you're not, you know, sort of urban enough. And I'm like, no, I'm not urban. I'm urbane. Yeah. Look it up.
Urbanic.
So you learn how to move and speak and then you're punished if you do that and you don't give them what they think, you don't speak the way you look.
But
the mind trip here for me. And this is why I drink, everybody.
No, but this the thing is though, I don't want to even come, like, listen, I feel we are not a monolith and I feel everybody, I appreciate the Migos. I really do. I appreciate the Migos. I appreciate all different types of genre of talking, whether it's, you know, a certain dialect. I don't have a problem with that. What I have a problem with is this algorithm that she is breaking down so eloquently that I want to sit in a room and sit in my closet for the rest of the day. Like, literally, well, that is so deep to me.
But you know what? In that case, that I think that is us or people using the algorithm or the tool of algorithms productively. Is there a problem with algorithms in general? Yes.
Yes.
In
this case, okay.
No.
No, I agree.
Yeah, I think this is a tool being used.
Okay, Mike's going to try to reel us in because we're in the pool already.
I'm going to reel you in a little bit here, okay?
There's so much going on, Mike. You can't bring her on here like this.
I know. Well, the concept of machine learning is the science fiction part to me anyway, that computers tell us who we are, what we're doing, and an algorithm is how many aspects of our lives are controlled, and people know how to control us through algorithms. So that's a whole science fiction concept right there. But I do want to get a little bit to how does ratio linguistics factor in, you know, cultural identity, ebonics, that type of thing. You know, what's the position on that? Because it seems like raciolinguistics is not just one thing. It's incorporating a lot of different disciplines to come up with data.
Yeah. Let me say one thing about the algorithm. The part of the reason why I did this study, like my master's thesis is just about Serena Williams. Where that research is now is this like larger study with the algorithm. And the reason I did it is because, you know, we think that algorithms are objective, but they are not objective because they are trained on text, and that text is created by humans, and humans have biases. And so what my research shows is that those biases are really plainly retrievable from a text. So basically the paper, you know, it ends with like, objectivity, who? I don't know her. you know. And that's like, for me, that's like the, you know, it's like the canary in the coal mine, even though everyone's already gone. It's just like, we already knew they weren't objective, but I just added another log to that fire. Okay. So raciolinguistics, how does it play into like culture and ebonics and all this other stuff? Mm-hmm. So, okay. Where to start answering this question? So for me, I think where we could see like raciolinguistics kind of intervening in some of these issues is perhaps on the stage of education. So really our field is nascent. Nobody actually has a job with a title raciolinguist. Like there's no professorship out there. People do this. It's new and it's very interdisciplinary. So people who've been working on language and education for a while have been applying like the critical lens that comes with, you know, just general linguistic knowledge plus, you know, social theory based on race. So ebonics is actually a great place to talk about this because there are many varieties of Black English, but if you were to survey Black people, a lot of them wouldn't tell you that they speak a different language other than English. And that idea that Black people have, they say they have ownership of English, or they don't know the history of what linguists would call a different variety or a dialect. And you know, what's traditionally been labeled as ebonics, is because of this language-less, a language ideology called language-lessness. And it is this idea that you don't have a language, that there's no language for your identity to have ownership over, that it doesn't actually exist, that it's not real or, robust or complex enough to be a real language. And so if we were to just type in like a list of the world's languages, you probably wouldn't find ebonics on it. Because
you'd find Klingon though. You'd find Klingon.
You sure would. Yeah. You'd find created languages or conlangs, which I know Ben talked about when he was here. So ebonics, you know, it became a word that people knew, during the Oakland ebonics controversy, when the California school system was trying to get Black students out of special ed classes and matriculating like English language learners. So we have students who speak Chinese, we have students who speak Spanish, who are able to have immersive education experiences in that language. The Supreme Court made that a federal mandate. But that federal mandate doesn't protect Black people, Black speakers, because legally, ebonics isn't a language. And if it was a language, it certainly wouldn't be a so-called foreign one. And so Black...
Wow.
Right. And so Black students don't have the same protections. And we see this playing out in other institutions as well. So because Ebonics, African-American vernacular English, Ave, right? All of these varieties, they don't have legal protections in the same way. So we see this play out in healthcare. We see it play out in the legal system where Black people can't have translators in court because they don't speak a, quote, foreign language. And so all of these ideologies, you know, the race and linguistics part kind of seeks to intervene at the education level and make, you know, self-expression the goal in a classroom instead of acquiring a proper or standard variety, which has been used to directly oppress people. It continues to be used to directly oppress people.
No. Well, all right. Sean has a question, but I do want to say something here. It's part of the irony of this, though, is that historically, like you said, we weren't allowed to read for at least 100 years. So we had no choice but to speak, and we were not taught how to speak properly. So that's part of our history. It's in our culture in this country. We had to, you know, make the language our own. But then the coolest parts of American language, all the phraseology that is considered cool, that's adopted around the world, you know, come from Black culture. So just got to point out that ironic fact for a second. Sean, you had a question.
My question is, well, it's not a question, but I'm just thinking back of when Trayvon Martin murder happened, and his best friend was on the stand, and she was being made fun of because a lot of people could not understand her language, her slang. But the funny thing about that was, and people, what I did not appreciate was that she spoke two other languages. Mm-hmm. I think she spoke Spanish, and she spoke, I think she was French. I think she was Haitian too. So I think she had a French mixture in there as well. And they didn't provide her with a person to interpret what she was saying. And they forced her to speak English, and she felt stronger speaking Spanish or French. And that was completely removed from the transcripts and from the media. The media made her into be a joke because of her, the way she spoke.
Yeah.
So she spoke two other languages. That's better than me. I mean, I could speak two possibly, but like she spoke through two other languages and English. So yeah, I just had to point that out.
Yeah, there's actually a considerable body of work about that trial and Rachel Gentel, especially how she was systematically discredited by the way that people interrupted her, including the jury. Jury members stood up in the jury box and asked for questions to be read back. And then they didn't consider any of her testimony in chambers. It was later reported. Rachel Gentel, I've met her. I sat next to her at a dinner.
You did?
Yeah, she came to a linguistics conference because she's like the star of this whole body of work.
Are you serious? Wow.
Yeah, she's amazing. Oh my gosh, she's amazing. I got to sit right next to her for like 2 hours.
Oh my God, this is, okay, where are you? I didn't find you on social media.
I know, right?
All right,
go
ahead, Leah.
I find myself really torn here because I'm not sure that I'm understanding. Are we saying that the way African Americans speak is so demonstrably different that it should be treated as a second language, and then would earn the protections that that ESL speakers get? Am I hearing that correctly?
That's a good question. That argument has certainly been made. As far as what linguists look for to determine the difference between a language and a dialect is a socially created one. There's a quote that some people don't love anymore, but I think is a good illustration is, a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. It's something that has institutional support, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And so, Black Black varieties of African-American varieties don't have armies and navies. So this is like part of saying, but that's like the social distinction, right? When we're looking at them structurally, there are enough differences in the deepest structural levels of African-American varieties, syntactic differences, which is just the way that words come together into a sentence, morphological differences, the way that we form words, you know, verbs, you know, the way that we use the be construction, right? That we can, mm-hmm. we can leave it out. We can put it in. It can go in a different order. All of those things, those deeper structural differences are what set it apart as its own system. What we want to politically, policy-wise, call that system, you know, has these different, like, institutional consequences. But really, most speakers of the variety wouldn't call it something different. And so for me, I'm torn between this, like, ethnographic versus, like, academic definition of, you know, the varieties. But these people need legal protection, right? And so that's one avenue to get it, is saying it, this is its own language.
Because I'm just, and maybe I'm using the phrase incorrectly, I'm just mm-hmm. like, how is that not just colloquial speech? And again, I'm showing my raising here, so to speak. There's the way you talk outside, you know, and there's, okay, now we have to talk to people. We have to mm-hmm. speak properly when we want to be, represent ourselves, you know, professionally or legally. And when one is unable to do that, to me, that speaks to the education system mm-hmm. and the inadequacies therein. So, and we're not being protected there right. either.
I completely agree with
Sometimes
you.
Sometimes it doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
I know. See, that's the other thing. This our generation likes to pretend, well, if I speak right, I'll be treated well. And that's not the case at all. But it's all I have left.
Well, at the end of the day, I think a large part of what you can get out of the study in this field, to me so far, is that language is just another tool of colonization and mm-hmm. white supremacy. Yeah. It's a tool, and the ways in which it is used against you, some mm-hmm. of it, a large part of it, you know, there's the obvious being called a name, but there's so many other ways subtly that you can, you know, describe, you know, like you said, Kelly, athletes by their physicality, suggesting that that's the only reason they're there. They're not, right. you know, they're not as good as, you know, these other, you know, white athletes, but that also comes down to the idea that all of these systems, and this is something I think Kelly and I were touching upon earlier, maybe off air, is that, you know, you have to consider white supremacy was happening when just about every form of communication we use was being created and influenced. So
the game is always rigged, no matter how well we learn how to play it.
Well, that's the thing, is who made the game?
Kind of.
Are you disagreeing with me anywhere, Kelly? Are you disagreeing?
No, I'm not disagreeing. It's so interesting about saying, like, isn't this just colloquial speech? Isn't this just casual speech? And so I would point to casual speech exists for everyone, no matter what your, you know, your first language or first variety is. Mm-hmm. But we don't treat the casual speech of people who use primarily standard English as a problem. We don't treat that as its own thing, its issue, as something to be corrected. And so when you look at, you know, a word like friendly, you know, nobody says friendly, right? We all say friendly, and we leave that D out. But for a standard American, for a white person, for a standard American speaker, for somebody who doesn't have a racialized variety or an accent, that kind of consonant deletion isn't a problem. But when you're a black kid and you're giving a speech in front of your classroom and you lose points for not enunciating or articulating, no one talks. Nobody speaks the way that language is actually written in a formal context, but only some groups are punished for it. This is like, is it the same as colloquial speech? Well, no. I mean, to me, the answer is no, because it's not treated the same. So it must be different. There must be something different about it.
So it's almost like, and I'm only saying this because I just finished reading the book, it's just another tool to reinforce caste.
Yep.
Yes. Well, wow. You know, it's interesting what you talk about the punishment here, because like I was saying, the sort of the irony or dichotomy, being black and speaking clearly, you get punished by your own people. I grew up with lots of kids asking me, why do I talk white? Why do you sound so white? You talk like a white man. Mm-hmm. You know, I eventually had, you know, a good comeback for that. You know, I would go, oh, really? I know white people who don't sound anything like me, but I think you're trying to say that I sound intelligent. And if you think to sound intelligent is white, then who's really been brainwashed?
So you would have been beaten up by the time you got to the end of that sentence. You would not have made it in childhood to the end of that sentence. But it is exactly what they're saying, and believe it or not, with accurate historical context, because we were locked out of education. And by the time we started acquiring it, it was a tool within the black community to separate out the talented 10th among us. So this is a real sore spot.
Nonsensical things.
are still tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org. I'm Mike Sargent. This is Night Shift, and we're still speaking with Kelly E. Wright, a raciolinguist, Sean Richards, and Leanne Lord. Leanne, you had something you were going to say based on what we were just talking about.
Yeah, you know, I have to say Kelly is my hero. You know, because, you know, when the word acts.
Hero or heroine? Wait, hero or heroine?
Hero.
Okay.
Whichever one she prefers to be identified as. How about that? But whatever I say, either with both admiration and respect, you know, because was growing up, you know, it was sort of drilled into you that saying acts was wrong as opposed to ask. And it never occurred to me that you could push back on that. Like, why do you think that sounds wrong? How about this? You know, to give that alternative or sort of take back your power. And just, I'm just really coming to grips with how it was drilled into us that one way of speaking was right and one way was clearly wrong. And it really did denote class. It denoted education. It denoted, you know, has so many negative connotations if you didn't speak right, to the point of being ostracized or even locked out of certain opportunities, which is just, you know. So I love the idea that she's taking that and pushing back and going, no, I'll see your axe and raise you comfortable.
All right. So, Kelly, let me ask you this. This kind of brings up to me the concept of linguistic anthropology. And what does raciolinguistics tell us about how a culture is evolving?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, anthropology, it's like the study of people, but they really only study non-white people. So I have, in the American context, the traditional discipline of linguistics arose out of anthropology. And so it's the study of people with a focus on language. I have not been trained as a linguistic anthropologist, although I know many, but it really is raciolinguistics. It just challenges the lens. So for example, I know you all have seen Arrival.
There are days that define your story beyond your life. Like the day they arrived.
Signs of what might be called first contact. The objects measure at least...
I'm Colonel G.T. Weber from Army Intelligence.
Pack your bags.
You're at the top of everyone's list when it comes to translations.
Priority one. What do they want? Where are they from? You'll be reporting to me, but you'll be working with him when you're in the show.
That's what they call a UFO.
I was being carted off in the medevac.
Not everyone is wired for what you're about to do.
So what do they look like?
You'll see soon enough.
Every 18 hours, a door opens up. That's where we go in.
Yeah, that just happened.
What happens now?
They arrive.
They need to see me.
Dr. Banks?
Are you insane?
Now that's a proper introduction.
More objects have landed around the world.
This is one of 12.
I'm never going to be able to speak their words.
Got 2 days. Figure something out.
I am human. It's their language.
We need to make sure that they understand the difference between a weapon and a tool. Language is messy, and sometimes one can be both.
Are you dreaming in their language?
Possible. They're prodding us to fight among ourselves.
This is just a way to force us to work together for once.
It's more complicated than that.
How is it more complicated?
Russia just executed one of their own to keep their secret.
Got 21 hours.
Before they start global war.
So how do we clarify their intentions?
I go back in.
How does this feel worse?
In Arrival, they when they start to figure out how the language system works of the heptapods, they mention this hypothesis called the superior wharf hypothesis. And this is the idea that language and society are intimately linked, that there's like a dialectic there. And so like the language itself in our minds creates the society, and the society itself then further reinforces and reshapes the language in our minds. And when you take this to the farthest, you know, point that it can go, it turns into something that can be quite dangerous. So in the, you know, the early years of the field, linguistic anthropologists, you know, are using this idea to say, oh, well, these Native American languages don't have a construction for future tense. And so they must not have a fully formed concept of time. Look at these natives that need our help, right? And so,
right.
No, that's not what it means. That's not what it means for language and society to be informed by each other. And when racial linguistics steps in and says, okay, for the moment you started asking questions, you were asking them from a place of all of these assumptions that are built into a colonialist mindset. So the idea that somebody didn't have something that was present in your language, making their entire culture worthy of paternalism, you know, like that's where racial linguistics steps in and says, let's just break all of the frames and start over from the data.
Right. Let's throw away this preconceived notion of what is correct or what is, because I have to say, I do not feel we live in an advanced culture. Yeah. It's not an advanced culture.
I have two very good friends of mine who are Native American, and, you know, to tell their stories about their grandparents not being able to keep the language going because of the white man, the colonization and all of that. It's just, it was a way to make sure that there was control. So when it comes to us, the same thing, it's like, we weren't really supposed to be around this long.
Nope.
Do you know what I mean? They, the way they made it, when there was any sort of progress, it was some sort of control. So for them to be always in control. So I feel like even the language thing, I mean, with the algorithm, it's just so deep. It's like, oh my God. My mind is blown.
Which I really want to go back and watch again. But
now I want to watch it again, too.
In my recollection, they spent more effort to understand an alien species than they did to try to understand fellow humans of a different culture.
Break it down, Lee. And that's what I was thinking.
And it's just like, huh.
I want to watch it again.
So y'all get that, but you don't get slang. Okay, I got you. I see y'all. I see what you're doing.
I saw, you know, but it, watch it again.
But it also reminds me, because I mean, just the entire premise of how do you communicate with someone who has a completely different communication system from you, and it to me that was absolutely fascinating. I have no idea how correct it was, but people, you know, professionally seem to like it. No, I'm like, you know how people in the field will watch something and go, "Nah, that's not true." But I, as a lay person, I enjoyed it. It also, of course, as a Star Trek fan, reminded me of that episode where in Next Generation, where the Enterprise met up with a species that communicated by story.
Mm-hmm.
And you understood, well, if you don't have the same stories, you don't have the same language. Like, you could say Romeo and Juliet, and just about everybody English speaking will know what that means. That's a story of young love. But if you're from a completely different planet, Romeo and Juliet has no meaning for you. So they were put together and they had to figure out each other's stories.
Yeah.
In order to communicate. Oh, I absolutely love that episode. And it's like, wow, I wish we could understand each other's stories better. You know, within our own species. Mm-hmm. And that seems like a reach.
It is definitely, that's science fiction. That's why they have to make it science fiction. All right. Now, a couple things this brings up to me, and I want to ask you in terms of, because you phrase a few things here where, you know, racial linguistics comes in, or where it helps or where it intersects. So one of the things that I feel you're hitting on is the racial and linguistic inequality. Mm-hmm. Where does racial linguistics fit into that paradigm, and how can the work you're doing either change or address it?
Yeah. So my work on housing discrimination, I think, illustrates this well. Discrimination legally, in this country, in most cases, must occur in physical proximity. Right? I have to stand in front of you for you to know that I am a woman of color. Right. And then for you to like do something discriminatory against me because of that identity. In housing, there have been studies. There were studies done in the early 90s showing by a linguist named John Baugh, who showed that if you call a landlord and you leave three identical voicemails using three different varieties of English, that there's a pattern to who gets called back, and it's most often the more standard speaker. And so I took it upon myself to redo this work in the contemporary market, looking at how the presence of individuals, so like people on Craigslist who are, you know, not really trained landlords, it's sort of have changed this phenomenon. And I guess the answer is it hasn't changed at all. So even though our market has changed considerably, even though people don't use the phone as much as they used to when trying to find a home, we still see the same effects of linguistic profiling happening with calls. So I used my three native dialects, which are African-American English, Standard American, and Southern American. I'm from Appalachia. I grew up in Tennessee. And what we find is that the Black voice not only, you know, has some explicit Fair Housing Act violations, so things like steering, which is where you inquire about one property, but you're steered back towards, like, the Black neighborhood, like, out of the rich neighborhood. And so what we find, I mean, essentially at the end of this is that Black voices are stereotyped, but even other non-standard voices like the standard or the Southern dialect, which is itself stereotyped, isn't as bad of a shape as Black speakers, because it's a white variety too. So we see that how white privilege works for a non-standard dialect. And then we see how a non-standard dialect that doesn't have white privilege is treated, and it's very different than the standard. So there's like this three-way distinction. And so, yeah, what we learn is that discrimination happens over the phone. And that essentially opening your mouth, you know, in any capacity where you have to open your mouth, you're opening yourself up to linguistic discrimination.
Linguistic profiling, I have to say. It's baked in.
Yep.
And then it's also a tool of discrimination.
You know, you said, Kelly, that this isn't an official thing. This isn't like, there's no department. Nobody's a professor of this. And I really feel like perhaps you're the pioneer of this, and that it will be a thing, or should be, you know, just so, I mean, because there are just the levels to this, you know, I mean, and language is core to communication. You know, for me, I have an example of what you just said in the other direction. You know, we all get on the phone, we're making appointments or doing things with our telephone voice. And if I can tell that someone on the other end, I believe, shares a cultural commonality with me, I will drop the professional speak and say something. You know, I usually try to be funny, you know, like, yeah, girl, I haven't had my coffee today either. And the minute I do that, they immediately match me. Mm-hmm. It never fails. And then we start having a better interaction. We weren't having a bad interaction, but I almost feel like that is the, we are linguistically seeing each other and trying to treat each other with that thought. And it's just my own little fun little experiment that I do, because I do also feel like it gets me better service, you know, or even just that, hey, sis, yeah, I see you. I know you're at work. I don't want you to be at work, but I'm glad you're there helping me. We both have like 2 minutes of a better day, you know, for that exchange. But yes, this is all very much in the field. This is not official studies.
Trust me, I have so many times if I had that happen to me. That and, you know, I only will say the sidebar is, you know, housing is one thing, but also when you're going in for a job, or when I was in sales, there was a time when I was in sales. I can think of instances both being in sales and applying for jobs where they talked to me. And they totally did not expect me to be some 6 foot two black guy. And they'd be like, oh, you were Mike Sargent. I thought you'd be taller, you know, something. They had no idea.
And back in the day, they didn't have the internet. They couldn't just search you and get a picture.
Nope. Yeah.
You know, so I remember fresh out of college.
You say back in the day as if I'm old. Now, what you mean? I'm kidding.
I'm sharing my back in the day story. You know, fresh out of college, fresh out of my indoctrination, I tried to get an apartment. You know, I called up. It was a nice little place in Brooklyn they were showing. When I got there, and they had apartments, of course, come on down. I get there, no apartments available. And I'm like, but I just spoke to you. Okay. And I was so upset. I had a friend, she was Italian. She was like, that doesn't sound right. And she called and she was told that there were apartments available. Right after I was told, after physically showing up, that there were, Yeah. And I was so, I don't know, mortified, discouraged. I was like, yeah, I don't want to live here anyway now. But it's like, this is happening in the 90s for real, y'all? Because we pretend things have changed. We think things are better just because there are laws. But you only have the rights that you can afford to pursue.
Well, now that brings in the last part of racial and linguistic inequality. What do you think some of this work, the racial linguistic work, can do in terms of, you know, addressing bias, changing policy, you know, shedding light, you know, what's some of the end game, and how do you think, you know, clearly you're going to be the pioneer. So how will you be changing the planet?
Well,
no pressure.
certainly standing on the shoulders of other scholars, already, but, so this study in housing, I think, is a good example, because I took a very specific legal issue, this physical proximity of discrimination, and designed an experiment specifically to generate data to address it. And this is like what people need to be doing. So in talking with legal experts about some other issues, and seeing how these cases that revolve around language in the past, like, so things about hate crimes and censorship, you know, these educational cases, what lawyers need to make these arguments is direct evidence. So even though we have a body of literature, you know, going back 20 or 30 years that addresses these issues in a broad way, I and other colleagues or other people who are working on these issues are designing experiments specifically to provide that data.
let me ask you a question. Well, first of all, I think it's fantastic what you're doing and what you're able to do with this data. And I think both Leanne and Sean believe you will be that person. A couple more questions before we let you go, before the show wraps up. In raciolinguistics, besides some of the topics we discussed, there are coded words. There are dog whistles, as they say. You created a corpus to look at how athletes are described. If they were to create corpuses for how Black people are portrayed in the news, how people of color are spoken about and racial groups are spoken about by politicians, you know, at these ridiculous rallies that are going on in this country, how can raciolinguistics intervene there, do you think?
The dog whistle work is actually really interesting because it intersects with very specific theoretical questions. So like semanticists, linguists who study meaning making, love dog whistles, right? Because they really stretch the limits of our like theoretical explanation. And so, and when we're talking about that, we're talking about like a theorem, you know, like in math or physics. And so I think that some raciolinguists, you know, because we're a nascent discipline, we are all kind of crawling out of kind of different disciplinary training. And so I think that this is kind of how the power is growing, in that we're taking a real world issue that has implications for our theoretical frameworks and kind of allowing race to be part of these central questions. So like my dissertation is about professionalism as a construct, and I'm looking at it from two perspectives. The first is a series of interviews, because Black people are not all the same. I want to understand how people in different professions with different backgrounds experience their professional lives. And then the other half is an experiment. Now, most people would start from the experiment stage, but I'm really just not, you know, we're really just not accepting that the frameworks that have been applied are adequate. And by adequate, I mean, they don't possess the capacity to explain all that we observe. This is what Newton asks us to do as scientists, right? We say that we're part of a Newtonian discipline in linguistics. Newton's goal was to describe everything that happens and everything that doesn't happen. That's his huge contribution to science, is like, the apple falls straight down. That's your first column. Your second column is, tell me why the apple doesn't do loop-de-loops, why it doesn't just hover in the air. You have to explain everything that doesn't happen. So I think raciolinguistics is coming in to say, okay, I need you to tell me why this doesn't happen for white people. I need you to tell me why this is only explainable in a laboratory setting, but we don't see people who speak using constructions like this. You know, I think that's really where the challenge works, is we are pushing the field to make the science more adequate, have more explanatory power.
You are tuned to Listener Sponsor Radio at WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the web at WBAI.org.
Leanne and Sean, I mean, the stuff she just said, you have to have some question or comment, or?
I mean, should I stretch mentally before? Like, you know, you stretch every day, like you're supposed to stretch every day. You're supposed to stretch your brain. And I feel like this whole segment has been so educational in so many ways. My question, or I'm not going to even put fear into this. I'm just going to say my question is, where do we go from knowing all this important data? How can we spread it to the masses? People spend so much time on their phone. This is something that I really like. I'm going to put this in my link. I want people to listen to this, but there's so much information. It's like they're setting you up. I feel like this whole, everything that I learned here, it confirms the setup and how the setup has been constructed by the masses, whether it's legally or just ethically. So, yeah, I don't know. Maybe I need to take a stretch and then have an
question. All right, Leanne, did you have a question before I go to my next question for Kelly?
I do, but I almost feel like Kelly's question is almost like a trick question or rhetorical, because it feels like all the answers, all the roads lead back to, well, why are we doing this? Why does it sound like this? Why? And it all goes back to supremacy, caste, and dominance. You know, when we say that this way of speaking the language is right and another way is wrong, we are automatically elevating one portion of the population. And we all know what part of the population that is. And, you know, there's the, I guess maybe the, on one end, people will say, well, that always benefits white people. Yes, in a way, absolutely. But then when you get to class, it doesn't. You know, because there are folks with Southern accents, or, you know, that different parts of our country are not seen as being as smart as others because of their accent, and it has nothing to do with their culture, you know, or their heritage. So there's a lot here, and it's like, okay, so what is the caste that's being supported? What is the dominance that's being supported and elevated? And I think people in our country, and they're clearly showing this, a real discomfort with looking at themselves and looking at their history. They always want to internalize it and personalize it. Well, I don't do that, and we shouldn't talk about this. And that's why we're going to be here in the same spot 50 years from now and 100 years from now, because we don't want to look in the mirror. And I'm saying we, because I was born here. You know, we all have something to see.
Are you talking about the humans?
The humans. Humans who right now are not being at their humanly best. You know, I always expect better, but the Dolphins are still winning.
This might be humans at their best. Kelly, what would be your response to Leanne's sort of question?
Yeah, I think so. Part of like, what do we do with this knowledge? Well, I think that as you know, from our group, from my disciplinary perspective, there's a handful of us who are trying to do the best we can to get into public communication of science, so we can begin talking about, you know, what our findings are and why they're important. There's a number of approachable resources that I can link to you, you all and the listening audience.
Please do.
Short things, you know, that give you a place to start a conversation. I think that honestly, we don't teach linguistics in this country in like primary or secondary education. So most people don't even learn things like basics about how language functions until college, if they learn it at all. And mm-hmm. So I think that for me, I really think that these issues, let me start over. Language ideologies in general live in the mind, right? So the only place to confront them is in the minds of individuals. And so I think it starts with conversations, not confrontations. However, if anyone's following me on Twitter, I definitely confront people about things that are problematic. I think that's part of it is doing the work of simply naming that, you know, the, well, there's reasons why we think this, and it goes back to, you know, these colonialist mindsets, or, you know, when you say speak proper, what you're really telling someone is to speak white. And like, mm-hmm. here's what that means. I think just the work of naming it shows that we've made progress, right? That people are aware of these things and that we're not afraid to speak them, because there was a point in time where we couldn't even stand up and say, this is wrong. And so I think just having conversations about it is where we're at right now. I wish that we were making this is like a generational task, right?
Is everybody there?
Did Mike leave?
No, that was just a space for music for a second there. I'm sorry. All right. So I was only going to really ask you one more question, but I really have to ask you two
since I have time.
All right. Well, I'm outnumbered by women here, and it is my perspective, whether you look at it from a historical perspective, anthropological perspective, cultural perspective, no matter how you look at it, I feel that when it comes down to the, let's say, the top three isms, the racism, classism, and sexism, I think sexism trumps them all. And because no matter what culture you go to, there's still some aspect or component that really, let's just say, puts women in a lower caste. So I'm just curious how racial linguistics and gender linguistics work together.
Gender-based linguistics have been around for a lot longer, pretty well-established field. And I think that, especially in a handful of talks I've heard even very recently, people who are pioneering many different approaches in gender linguistics are now integrating race into their theory. So I think we've all really been informed a lot by intersectionality. In the work I did on Serena Williams and in this work on housing that I used my own voice for, you know, people very often ask, like, well, how do you know this isn't about sexism? How do you know that what's happening is about race? And I think my answer to that is, well, I'm always a Black woman. I'm never just one. So I can't tell you specifically if what I'm looking at has nothing to do with my femininity. All I know is that I can't be one and not the other. And so I think that this push for understanding intersectionality, for understanding these identity constructions as clusters instead of individual categories that you might be able to move in and out of, or might be able to be singularly perceived, I think that this is where what we're learning from gender linguistics and racial linguistics are coming together to kind of, again, like, buck those assumptions, change those categorization trends, make things like more about self-identification than, you know, the way a researcher is perceiving a participant and things like that. So I think just leaving space for self-expression is kind of the big lesson that's being applied. And we have yet to see how that's going to reshape our theory. This is part of why I'm excited to be in the field, is because we'll be learning for the rest of my lifetime, and that makes me happy.
No, listen, I love it. And, you know, we got to have you come on, you know, periodically to give us updates. So
yeah, we didn't talk about slurs or slang or
no,
or
we will
appropriation. Anyway.
No. Well, I do want to ask.
That's part two.
That's part two. So you got to have you come back.
Like, I want her to be monthly. Like, she should come in just to check on us mentally. And
monthly. We had the monthly.
Monthly, mentally.
The Kelly segment, yes.
Even if you just stepped in, but Kelly, seriously, even if you just stepped in for like 10 minutes, just to, I mean, I would like to dissect anything, even if someone left me a voice message or if someone.
That's right. You can try to have Kelly. Kelly,
I know,
now
it's a therapy
session. Tells you like it is, all right?
You know, that segment could be, this is what they said, but this is what they meant. My God. I love it. No, seriously. I mean, there's so many things. I feel like the question mark didn't get the dot at the bottom. I just have to go through the
checklist. Well, okay. So it's settled that you have to come back, but we still have a little bit more time. You know, we didn't really talk about colloquialisms that much in slang, but I do want to talk about slang in the context of how words evolve culturally, where you can have a word means one thing in one era, or in one country, like the word cholo. It didn't mean the derogatory term it means here in America. It had a completely different meaning in South American countries, or how a word that at one point was meant to be derogatory, and we'll just say the N-word, then it eventually becomes, we appropriate it and make it something else. So you it evolves. You embrace or rejecting culturally derogatory terms. So I wanted you to weigh in on that, Kelly, if you could.
Yeah. All right. So language is a natural system. And because of that, it behaves similarly to other natural systems. So, you know, our climate or our solar system or our biology. And so what that tells us then is that this language is the change that's going on in a language, is continuous and ongoing. It's never static, right? So that fallacy of the dictionary, that a word is real if it's in the dictionary, and, you know, and what it means is something you could just thumb through and point to, right? That's really not how language is working day to day. So all words have unique histories, and there's debate on whether if the sense of a word or the way that it's used changes, is that a new word with a new history, or do we talk about like semantic change, like meaning changing over time? So you have a word like, for example, which used to just mean male chicken, but then was sexualized. So very much in the way that we're talking about racialization, like a word becoming racialized, like thug, right? We have a word like, which was totally fine to say. People walked around talking about their male chickens with no problems. And then, you know, and then...
As men tend to do. They're always talking about their male chickens.
I mean, you know, you're just having like conversations about the farm on market day, whatever. No problems. And then we have the Victorian period where all of a sudden everything becomes sexualized. We can't talk about our bodies. We can't show our bodies, right? Nobody talks about anything, and everything is perverse. And so all of a sudden we need a new word for male chicken. And so we introduce the word rooster, which essentially is made up. I mean, pretty much every word is made up. And the only reason why we needed a new word is because the way people were feeling about what we were referring to changed. The surrounding ideology changed, and it pushed us into this place where we needed a new word. And we saw all of this happen like during the pandemic, right? Like our social circumstances change and language just expands to fill, you know, this new space. And so this kind of like constant change affects appropriation in both directions. So people taking words from cultures that are not theirs and like reassessing them in the reference to their own culture. So an example is like, we say like tamales, like I'm going to get some tamales, but tamale was like already plural. The single is tamal, right? So when we brought the word tamales and the dish and all of this like into, you know, our English speaking culture, it was like pluralized by our own rules, right? So that's like one way we can see appropriation. But then we look at like a word like the N-word, which, you know, I would argue there are multiple versions of this word, that they're different words because they have a different history. And so the, you know, what we hear in rap songs, you know, the version that ends in A or AH, that is a different term. That is not the same word, you know, that was used by overseers on a plantation yard, right? That was written in passenger manifests to right. describe your, you know, load, right? This is something, it's a term of endearment. It's how we recognize each other. And what the rhetorical work, right, that word is doing is completely different than the labeling, the less than, the slur version. And so I think that when we're thinking about language evolving, it really is that time is moving forward. Time is linear. And therefore, and meaning is made in interaction. And so we're kind of always reassessing language, which is why people need to like calm down about new words, you know, arising, like, and people not understanding them. But at the same time, when, you know, people who are not part of, like Black culture, take these words and try and say, oh, this is just how teenagers speak, or, you know, that they erase the origin of the word and try and claim ownership of it. This is like where like the grayest parts of this conversation are for me when we begin to talk about ownership of a term.
I'm afraid that's all the night shift we have time for this evening. If anything of substance has been cut out, I imagine you'll hear it on next week's program. But it's coming up on midnight here at WBAI New York, 99.5 FM.